Today's the 4th of February, interviewing David Marden, the senior family member of Purnell Orchard Limited. Tell us about the Marden family from the start till today. David, would you like to just start off by telling me some of the details?
Okay. Well, part of the property's been in the family for just over 100 years. My grandmother and grandfather on my father's side had a portion, had 10 acres in Evenden Road. And then when the old man got married in 36, he bought 6 acres on that bounded Parkaway Road, but also had a common boundary with the portion of his parents' property. So that was the original land holding. Now, if we go back a bit as far as my paternal grandmother, she was one of 12 children, 3 girls and 9 boys. And her mum came out from the UK about 1869, I think. Or 59. I'll have a look. Oh, 1863.
Yes.
When she was 18 years of age. Her family were going to come out with her, but they didn't, and then they abandoned the idea of immigration, and she never saw them again. And she was a nursery governess to the Fitzgerald family, and later to the Rhodes family, and this was in Christchurch. Now, on the 10th of March 1868, she married Francis Lowe in Christchurch. Now, Francis, his family had immigrated to Tasmania when he was just a child, and I think there were 2 or 3 boys that came over with them. And they... just prior to 1868, either one or two of his brothers and himself came over from Tassie to Canterbury. It was either something to do with horses or sheep or something of that nature. Anyway, just how many of those boys stayed on, I don't know, but Francis, the one that we're interested in, did. And he and Phoebe, that was the... great-grandmother's name, married and lived in Christchurch for about 3 years. Then they took up land at Mount Hutt near Ikaya, and they lived there for 9 years. They later lived in Tynwald, again in Canterbury. Mm. In 1897, the family came to the North Island and set up a flax mill in the Manamatu. And then in 1898, they moved to Waipawa, where Frank... that's the husband, worked on the new railway. And then a bit further, in 1899, they came to Hastings and drew a block in the Mahora area settlement in a ballot. That was in Parkaway Road down near Frederick Street. And it was from there that my grandmother lived, and she originally, or she was married, I think, around here, but she and her husband, Harry Marden, who was involved in flax milling in the Manamatu, they lived in the Manamatu, in Palmerston North. And I remember seeing the house that they lived in, and funnily enough, the plans that had been made for that house. And it was in... Featherston Street, I think. And from my recollection, my dad and his brother and twin sisters were all brought up in Palmerston North.
Right.
He used to tell stories of living in the urban area of Palmerston North.
Yes, yes.
Now, just what brought them up to Hastings, I'm not sure. Sure, his wife's family lived up here. But the old man had, Harry Marden had, I think, dust on his lungs from flax milling, which was a common thing.
Yes, sure, yes.
So they came up and bought the portion of land in Evenden Road. Now, it had some fruit on it. Plums, peaches, some apples, but the biggest area was bare land. And I think they grew spuds and had cows. And I don't believe old Harry did much with the fruit. From what I've heard, my grandmother had a tea rooms in Hastings at one stage. And I think the fruit was dealt with by my dad's uncle, one of the nine brothers that I mentioned earlier.
Sure.
And they lived in Ryakākahu Road, opposite the race course.
Yes,
and I'll get it right yet.
Yes.
Opposite the sale yards.
Yes, sure.
And their place was called Sunnybank. Now, I think he dealt with the fruit. He had more experience than the old man, than Harry. So, now, as far as my dad was concerned, as I said, he went to school in Palmerston North. Born in 1898. So, by the time they moved up here, he was a teenager, I guess.
Yes, he would have been.
So, I don't know that he might have done a little bit of schooling, high schooling, up here. But I think Harry wanted him to be a plumber, and he wasn't that thrilled about that idea. So he said he would go down and work with his uncle, that was another of the nine brothers, in Canterbury. His old uncle had a farm at Hines in mid-Canterbury, where he had, it was quite big, I think, he had stock, wheat, you know, all of that sort of stuff, and a lot of horses.
Yes.
And of course, in those days, horses were a dominant feature from the draft horse. And they had the old German bulldog tractors.
Yes.
And he often recalled that. So, I'm not sure how long he was there, but he, World War One, of course, intervened. His brother, who was a couple of years, two or three years older than him, was a Gallipoli veteran, and then on the Somme. But the old man went to Featherston training and trained on Vickers machine guns. Now, he had said that they were in, the group that he was with was the best trained Vickers group that had come through that area. And there was another hiccup, which I take it he was always regretful of. And it was something to do with his brother coming home from First World War. And they took the old man out of the group that he was with and put him back with his brother or something. And the group that the old man was with went overseas and really just got over there and it was all over. And that was, the old fellow often said that one of his big regrets that he didn't get away on that trip.
Mm.
But then, you never know, the Spanish flu was part of that issue too. So
yes.
And I think he had a touch of the flu. Okay, so he did shepherding, bushfalling, worked on numerous stations around this area, Mungahani and up the Wairoa way, I think, a wee bit. Also did some shepherding on Kidnapper Station.
Right. Gordon's.
Gordon's. Then spent, I think, the next 20 years as a solo mutton butcher at Whakatū. So
he started at Whakatū. He never worked at Pucky Puck Freezing
Pots. No.
Oh, that's I didn't realise.
No, I don't believe so.
Yes, I didn't realise that solo butchering at Whakatū.
Oh, a few years ago I saw a photo of all the guys on the on the floor,
mm.
and there was quite a row of them.
Yes. You know. So how many years did he work at Waka 2?
I think he worked 20 years.
Gosh.
Yeah. And what was it? 105 big sheep or 120 lambs,
mm.
I think,
mm.
was the day's average tally or something.
It's interesting. I've just interviewed yesterday Bruce Jenkinson, who was the works manager for 23 years at Waka 2. He was the one that had to take the flag down and lock the gates.
Oh, okay.
And it's quite interesting finding out, you know.
Yeah, a little bit.
And because I think their biggest lamb kill was 2 million in a year. And I know I've just done Timona as well.
Mm.
And they, their biggest day was 20,000.
Mm.
Imagine 20,000 sheep. How many truckloads? The awful
exactly.
blood.
What an awful lot.
So anyway, coming back to
okay,
that.
Okay, so I recall...
Was he married?
No.
Okay.
We'll cover that next then. Okay, so now on my mum's side, she came from Canterbury, Ashburton. And the family had a farm at Waterton, which is between Ashburton and the coast. Not brilliant land, I don't think. But then they bought the old man and I think his sons bought near a Methven, a place called Lyndhurst. Mother trained as a nurse at the Ashburton Hospital. And in 1933, answered an ad for a nursing job in the Navy Hospital. That was post-earthquake. A lot of nurses were killed in the...
Yes.
Night nurses were killed in the nurses' home.
Yes, that's right.
And, of course, they were short of nurses. So that that's what brought her up to Hawke's Bay.
Yeah.
And her sister-in-law-to-be, one of Dad's twin sisters, was also nursing at Napier. And I think that's the link.
Mm.
Sunday night teas, I think, were in those years quite an issue.
Sure, sure.
Mother being on her own over there, and Ellie was the sister-in-law to be, brought her out, and I think that was the link. So they were married in 1936, and both went down to Canterbury to her family to be married,
mm.
and had been negotiating this 6-acre block that an old bachelor by the name of McNabb had.
Yes.
And I think the old grandfather sent him a telegram while they were en route to Canterbury to say that the deal had gone through.
Right.
So, married in 1936, had to get the old home tidied up a bit, which I think another really helped them with. It was a little old, typical villa cottage thing.
Yes, yes.
Which was quite close to the road over on the main block over there. So, that first year, 37 or 36, it doesn't matter, they got caught with the frost.
Yes.
There was a significant frost in the district,
mm.
Which basically cost them all the fruit they had.
Sure.
So he went, the old man went back to the works for that year. Now, 37, I think, might have been reasonable. 38 was the year of the flood.
Yes.
Another significant event in the Hastings area.
Especially here when you think the water used to go right up to Timona Works.
That's right. Well, in actual fact, in 38 it came up to the front gate.
Yes.
Over here, which is in front of this lot.
Yes.
Didn't get in the house, but... and that was April. And the I think he had a lot of fruit stacked out in the orchard. And he we got a replica of the wheelbarrow, and the wheelbarrow had a motorbike wheel and just a couple of shafts and handles on the end that you could stack bushel cases on. So he, I think he wheeled the whole lot out with a wheelbarrow.
Good Lord, yeah.
And I don't believe he had any or much packing facilities then, and I'm guessing the old uncle might have had something to do with what happened to the fruit.
Sure.
And I think they built a packing shed in 39 and put a Benjamin screw-type grader in.
Sure.
And I think he bought that new. And my recollections are of the old shed and of the grader. And that was in the days when fruit was picked in bushel cases.
Yes.
Put stacked in the shed and tipped into the hopper one by one.
Yes.
Put over the grading table that this particular grader utilised. Screw type sizing method, sized by size and shape rather than by weight. Packed into wooden cases in every apple rack.
Mm.
So, yeah. And my recollection of Sturmers, that he would pick the whole Sturmer crop, stack it in the shed, and pack it out at their leisure.
Yes, when they used to say they were waiting for the bruises to come out.
No, especially on Sturmer.
That's right, I know.
And they seem to keep it.
Yes, yes.
You can't do that today.
No.
So, yeah, that grader was used right up until the 60s. So that was about 39, I think. That, and his parents both died within a few weeks of each other in 1942.
Hmm.
I think the old man had a bladder problem. And whenever I ask about the grandmother... she was bedridden for 3 years, I think. And whenever I asked what the problem was, it was creeping paralysis, whatever creeping paralysis was.
Well, that was Parkinson's, wasn't it?
Well, I wonder too, but...
No. Creeping paralysis was MS. Multiple sclerosis.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I don't think it was the shaky part.
No, it was multiple sclerosis.
Yeah. And, I haven't mentioned much about the Lowe family, the nine brothers and three sisters, and a lot of them lived around here. And my grandmother was the eldest daughter. Mm. The next one lived over the road in Pakawai Road here. She married a chap, Beach, Annie Beach was her name. I have recollections of... Christmas nights over at their place, and her son being Father Christmas. She lost one son in the Second World War. Then the other daughter was Sophie, and she lived in Percival Road.
Yes.
She was, her family was the Albert Hill family.
Okay.
And there was 18 years... another little significant issue. She was 18 years younger than the eldest, her eldest sibling, and her children, she had three or four, and there was 20 years between the oldest and the youngest.
Goodness me.
And Ted is that one.
Yes.
And of... the old man had 75 cousins on his...
Did he?
On his dad's mum's side.
Yes.
I think there's four left. There's Ted, Tom Lowe, Reuben Lowe, Reuben and Jenny, and their brother and sister. Mm. And they are of the Archie Lowe family, the one opposite the sale yards.
Well, I didn't realise that you were related to Ted.
Yeah, oh yeah.
Yes.
Fiery Ted's lot.
Oh, I know, I've had a few run-ins with that. Yeah. That's interesting. With your association, Blood's association with the Low family, you never wanted to go and climb any mountains or anything
that? No.
My reference there is
Yeah, to of you. Course, to George.
That's right.
Yeah. That was always a sore point with the old man that Ed Hillary got
the kudos
and George didn't make it. But
yes.
In speaking to George's brother, he had often said, George had often said that the right guy got to the top, especially if you looked at their lives post Everest.
Yes.
The George went back teaching, Ed made a fantastic job of the relationships between him and the Nepalese.
Yes.
And I don't think anybody else could have done that job as well
and
as that.
And then, you know, later in his life, he went to India as the ambassador.
Yeah, yeah,
and
yeah.
So, you know,
he paid a price, losing his daughter and wife.
A man of his times.
Yeah, yep, yeah,
no,
I
think he was a great person.
Yeah. Okay, so that's... And there's still a number of those families around here.
Certainly.
Okay, so... from the orcharding point of view, I was born in 37, went to the local Mahora school and then to Hastings Boys for a couple of years, and came back and started here in 53. In those years, we were running a mail order trade in conjunction with the railway to the lower half of the North Island. And that was not an easy issue. Dealing with the railway was one issue in itself, but because from a freight point of view, my recollections are that the old man liked to send as many packages to Mrs. Jones, if she had ordered, as he could on the one occasion.
Certainly.
And that was fraught with problems. Yeah, you had to have them in at the rail at 11 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah, sure.
And they either had to be picked the afternoon before or on that morning to give them life.
Yes, certainly.
They were put in uncooled wagons and... I think that from Ekitahuna north was sent by truck and the rest of it was by rail.
Sure.
And I usually ended up with a job of taking them in there. We had an old 27 Chrysler that had been cut down into a ute.
Sure.
And I was always late and always in strife with the guys down the rail. And of course, they were government employees they got paid no matter what, so if you made their life difficult, well, they made it difficult for you.
That's right.
And so it was 11 o'clock for private orders and it was 4 o'clock for market fruit. And I was usually late for market fruit too. That's the way it was. And I think in general, although we did have problems, the rail got it there most times. In reasonable order. Today we do a bit of courier work, there's still the odd hiccup with that.
Yes, I always remember, and this must have been with one of the blocks of land you acquired. I don't know whether it was later in your time. But you planted potatoes and got
Well, in 54, I think it was, we bought 20 acres on our northern boundary. Now, where we are here, of course, is highly fertile soils of the Hiratonga Plain, now known as the Plain Zone, with some degree of protection. And... We we paid, I think, £375 an acre, which was quite big money. But then all we had to do was pull the fence out. And I've always said that if anybody can afford to pay the bigger dollar for a property, it's the guy straight next door. It's simplicity for him to expand.
Absolutely,
into it.
Yes.
So we planted some trees in 54, and the majority of that planting was Granny Smith, and we ended up having 10 acres of Granny Smith, which was almost unheard of in those days. In fact, I think it was the biggest planting around. And in those days, the plantings were 100 trees to the acre, and the tendency was not to crop them to any extent for the first few years. So you cropped in between the trees. Mm. And the first couple of years we grew tomatoes for the cannery, Scoresby tomatoes. And I think we grew in both those years around about 180 ton.
Mm.
And we had Samoan women picking them. And the plants were quite wide, quite big. And we had an old, we'd bought an old single back axle wheel Bedford. Well, it wasn't old, it was relatively young, from Mahora Stud Farm up the road.
Mm.
And it'd been designed for carton, but a stock, and the deck was too big for, but still. It was actually ideal for the tomatoes because you could straddle the row, and the dual wheels at the back would have torn up the plants, but the single didn't. 64 wadi boxes, 6 trips a day.
I know.
But at least you could pick them up and put them on the truck.
Yes.
And take them to Wadi's, and Wadi's was 10 minutes away.
Yes.
And not have to take them off again.
That's
right. So they were palletized. You stacked them on pallets on the truck,
right.
And then they offloaded the pallets at Wadi's. Then the following year, and we were increasing the planting, apple plantings over that time. The following year, we planted potatoes. Now, there's a little irony because a few years ago on national radio, I heard a talk about the great potato famine of the 50s. And I pricked my ears up, and it gave a bit of history because I was aware that in that particular deal with the potatoes, we'd done pretty well. And from what I gather, Canterbury was the ringleader of the issue. There'd been a lot of tomatoes planted the year before, potatoes planted the year before. And there'd been a glut, and so a lot of the traditional growers backed off the next year,
sure.
and backed off quite considerably, apparently. And potatoes in that particular year were extremely short.
Mm.
Now, I think we had approaches by two or three firms about buying the crop in the paddock,
sure.
And the old man wouldn't have that.
Mm.
And I think we were getting £90 a ton, and I can't remember the tonnage. But he also was getting £35 a ton for basically pig potatoes, little rubbish.
Yeah.
So, and I can't remember what the end figure was, but he paid off the property and bought a car.
Yes. So, yes, I always remember that story.
Yeah. There hasn't been many incidents like that since, but Frank, it's
I always remember your father when we were, Kay and I were here packing in the shed, and he was a great one on Safer Sleep electric blankets.
Oh God, because he had a mate, I could tell you.
That's
about
right.
That too.
And so anyway, he sold us this, and I'm sorry, but it stopped working about 6 years ago.
Oh. Well the guy that built it stopped working a long time ago.
It was 50 years.
Oh, God.
So it didn't
turn. Yeah, well, that was a situation where this guy, he was a young chap, was working in one of the local banks, and it was not his hometown. And he was at a loss one Sunday afternoon, and I think in those years, mother sold fruit at the gate, and they had to come into the shed.
Mm.
And they must have been puddling around on this Sunday afternoon working, and he bought some fruit and hung around, and I think stayed to tea, and from that developed a contact, and a lifelong friendship.
Yes, yeah.
And then he went back. He got out of the bank eventually, I think, and started up a electrical import business.
Mm.
And that's how the blanket issue.
Yeah, so it's always interesting.
Yeah, yeah. And then his son came up and went to Lindisfarne in latter years. And
So that's the orchard is planted, the potatoes. It's all cashed up, all paid for.
Yeah, basically. And we then were looking at the apple plantings coming on stream. And as I said, there wasn't 10 acres for a start of Granny Smith. Mm. There was, from recollections, there was 19 rows of 35 in a row. That was across the block. Then we had three, in that same patch, we had 3 rows of Goldens, 2 rows of Red Delicious, 12 rows of Golden Queen, 6 rows of Cox's Orange, 2 rows of Kids Orange, 3 of Goldens, 6 of Grannies, and 3 of William Bond Crescent Pears.
Mm-hmm.
And that brought up. Northern Spy rootstocks on the Grannies and some of the others. Some of the Grannies were on Morling 12, which was a disaster, and some were on Morning 16. They weren't. Spy was by far the best. The others were too vigorous in the soil that we had.
These were all multi-leader.
All multi-leader. Too. Yeah, yeah. So that's more than usually 3 or 4 uprights. And in those early years, the early pruning was not done to any real degree. The old man didn't know a great deal about it. And as the years went on and Phil and I got more involved and interested and picked up more knowledge, we rehashed the trees quite significantly.
So it was during this period Philip must have come home from...
Oh, yeah, Philip came home the next year. Yes. I think he came home in 54.
Yes.
So in those years, I remember pulling willow trees out because there was a patch in the original block that he bought had half a dozen big willows in.
Mm-hmm.
Where you know you basically dug the bloody great hole around them and cut all the roots off.
I know.
And then pushed them over. We had an old sprayer. Made out of a truck chassis which had a 300-gallon water tank on it and a friend pump, and a couple of guys stood on the back, and then a driver and the guys that were doing the spraying stood on the back with a gun each.
Yeah, sure.
So the driver positioned them in the centre of the 4 trees.
Yes.
And then moved them up to the next 4 and moved them up to the next 4 and moved them up, and the amount of fruit you grew in those years really hinged on what you could spray.
Yes, that's... Yes.
Because if we go back a step, when the old man first started, the 6-acre block was what they call reticulated. It had pipes underground.
Yes, yes.
And a pump, a spray shed and pump up at the house. And it emptied the tank there and pumped it through the pipes. And the operator had a 100-foot of hose that you just shifted from tap to tap. And walked around each tree and sprayed it.
Yes, yes.
And that was a very limiting factor.
Oh, yes, yes. I know a lot of the orchards in our area
all
were reticulated.
Yeah, 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 yeah. And that was a hard job.
Oh, absolutely.
Because a pressurized 600-pound pressure hose was had a mind of its own, and you had to fight it. So we moved through the 50s and gradually dropped the private order trade and started supplying the Apple and Pear Board with more fruit. We always had supplied them. And in those days, of course, it was you were allowed to sell a couple of cases of fruit to an individual, but you couldn't sell it for resale.
No, that's right.
And, there's a lot of history involved in how that developed and the success that it had over all those years, especially in the from the 70s on.
Sure.
So we... by the time we reached the 60s, we were really pushing the poor old Benjamin Grater. The fruit industry in Nelson had developed a thing called the Ansa Grater.
Yes.
And we waited 2 or 3 years while they perfected it, but they never really did. The principle was wrong, and it was a brutal unit on fruit. It did have rotary bins, was an advantage. So we rehashed the Benjamin and put that on one side of the answer. And we used that through the 60s up until 69, I think. And I can't remember the figures that we were packing at that stage, but it was certainly climbing up. When we got to the mid-80s, we were packing 20,000 grannies.
Mm. Must have been during this period you got your new blast sprayer too.
Yeah, well, I suppose that's right. Now, I suppose if you look at the spraying deal, in the mid-50s, there was a package came out called a Besblow, which had a Wisconsin motor and a fan and a set of nozzles.
Yes.
And you could clamp that to, or bolt it to... an existing sprayer, so we put it on the old truck unit.
Yes, sure.
And that was the first real introduction to air blast,
sure.
where air enhances
the
ability to get spray into the tree.
Yeah.
And there's no doubt that revolutionised spraying. We had that for a number of years, and then we bought, and it must have been. Late 50s or early 60s, a John Bean.
I remember.
Yeah.
We all came and had a look at
it. Yeah, what was it? It's a 454 model with a big six-cylinder GM motor.
That's right.
A very well-built unit, yes, there's no doubt about it. Steel tank, unfortunately, and there was no fiberglass in those days.
That's right.
And that's the... So we used that for a number of years. And then we got another model, 377, which was a bit smaller. And we've still got that, although we don't use it. There's a bit of history with that, because when the oil shocks came, we went away from petrol and we put a high-speed diesel in it, which was we had 10 difficult years out of it.
Mm.
And then we put a Isuzu in it, and that sort of solved all those problems.
Sure.
So.
Mm.
But so if we come back to the grading situation... And bulk handling, because that was developed in Nelson in New Zealand for a start. And prior to that idea, we were picking into bushel cases.
Mm.
And then when bulk handling came along, they were 8x4 footprint, I think. That's in the old measurement.
Yes.
Bins of that nature. But of course the key to all of that was hydraulics.
That's right.
You know? Mm. And I think forklifts were used at the tail end of the war, weren't they?
Mm.
Whoever invented them was
a
saver.
Certainly were.
Because
when I think of the numbers of cases I've put up in those hoppers.
And when I think of the cases that we used to take the apple and pear board, well, if you start off at picking, you picked it into a bushel, you stacked it on usually a couple of bits of 4x2, and you made a heap.
Mm.
And then you brought the tractor and trailer down and you put them on the trailer and then you stacked them on the trailer. Then you took them to the shed and you took them off the trailer and you stacked them in the shed.
That's right.
And that was just the beginning.
I know.
So there's a number of things that have really made a difference. But the principle of hydraulics in farming and material handling is just, saved a hell of a lot of backs.
You haven't forgotten the case-making machine.
Well, and there's the case-making too. When you think
of all the apple boxes, you had to make enough to pack into and then nail them down.
Yeah, and Frank, somewhere I've got a booklet by the Cutler grading people.
Yes.
They're in Portland, Oregon, or they were.
Mm.
And I've seen some letters sent from Wenatchee and... Yakima, just commending the fact that the Cutler people, they were using it as advertising on their machines. And this one pack house had 32 Cutler graders, and they packed 1.5 million or something. And that was in the days of wooden boxes.
Mm.
And I don't know whether they were making them by machine this was the
20s. Yeah, sure.
Gigantic amount of work.
I know, but it was just part of the thing.
Yeah, yeah. I think in those years, cool stores were multi-layered. There was, you went up lifts.
That's right.
And it was no pallets, it was all dunnage.
I know.
And with the
rat hole doors.
Jeffrey's cool store.
Yes.
Yeah.
But that's the way it was done then.
We didn't know.
And when you think now that they just go through an air curtain into a cool store and bring
it out. When I first took fruit to the Apple and Pear Board, no pallets, and you picked every case up off the truck and you put it on a conveyor alongside the floor of the building was raised. It wasn't ground level. And the trucks that we had were usually lower than the average.
Mm.
And the conveyor was bloody near over your head. And I can still hear the noise of the fruit being pushed down the conveyors. And all that went into cool stores with dunnage.
Yes.
And then when the first forklifts arrived down there, two little two-cylinder Coventry Climaxes. So bulk handling was the late 50s.
Yes.
And in the 60s, we swung over to trailers, 90 bushel trailers to pick into. And I don't know who came up with that idea, but looking back on it, it was a bit crazy because you couldn't put them in cool store.
That's right.
You had to have covers over them, so your packing rate had to be fairly smart. And you dry dump them. Mm. That means no water was involved.
That's right.
So the innovations that came out of the apple industry in this country were the bulk handling and then using water as a medium to get the fruit out of the pin.
Mm.
And lucky that apples floated.
Yes.
Pears were always difficult. Mm. You had to increase the density. And the materials used for that made them slippery and greasy. So that was never... a brilliant deal, but the water method of getting fruit out of a bin is perfection. It's just it's simple,
it is.
And extremely effective.
Mm.
And of course, with required hydraulics, whether it be a forklift or so we'd use this Ansa and Benjamin combination up until the late 60s. And there had been a guy in Tauranga who had developed an orbit grader for kiwi fruit. And the principle of that thing... sizing accuracy was always the big problem. And the graders made in this country sized by the size of the fruit. The imported Cutler that I've just mentioned used a weight system, which was certainly better. And there were a number of Cutler graders around Slater's in town had three or four, and Hopes had them. And in fact, I think Hopes had the first one I ever saw was Rotary Burns.
Yes.
Anyway, so back to the orbit. This orbit idea used wands, and it threw the fruit up into a shelving, canvas shelving. The principle of it was that you applied the same amount of energy, released the same amount of energy to each apple or each fruit. The heavier the fruit, the shorter distance. The lighter the fruit, the higher distance. So you had, if you imagine the steps of a ladder leaning, and from all of those steps you have chutes.
Mm.
Well, you tossed it up into the chutes, and then it slid down. And the sizing was pretty accurate.
Sure.
And it was quite gentle. And the Gillespie boys had one.
Yes, yes.
And there were others around. They were using it on apples. So anyway, we got in contact with the guy, John Hancock, from up at Tipuna, and about building us something. And he came up with the idea of, instead of the chutes taking the fruit all the way back to a common level, why don't we leave the fruit at that same level that it was tossed at, and have a bin configuration like multi-level cake plates?
Yes, yes.
And so we went with that idea, and tossed out the old grader, and this new one was going to be up and running, ha-ha, for the season. Well, it wasn't, and we were going to use water to feed the to take the fruit from the trailers. So the fruit slid into the water and then got elevated out. He had quite an ingenious sorting table, which I can't remember the details of now, but it was not too bad. Now, the whole unit was a bit slow, and his engineering of the cake plates was not brilliant. He had 10-foot diameter coned shape canvas as the bin, and it had a friction drive to turn it round. Well, the friction was hit and miss, and the problem became apparent because the cone was made out of canvas. It would pocket, and you would get a heap of fruit in one spot and nothing in another. And, of course, that upset the balance as well.
Yes.
Now, the idea was that instead of walking along the grader, you went up and down on a unit that went vertically.
Yes.
The principle being that you could stand on the unit, pull yourself up with a counterweight. When you'd filled the box, you were, 18 kilograms heavier. Therefore, the whole unit would come back to ground level and put it on the conveyor and get a new box, and you're 18 kilograms lighter, so you go up. Now, if it had been engineered better, maybe it would have been better. But there was another fundamental principle that was forgotten about. These two cake plate units were on two axes, and they overlapped where the feed system went in.
Sure.
Now, when you throw something, the orbit of that is in a straight line.
Yes.
And unfortunately, when they entered the chute, they had to change direction slightly. And I remember we had some beautiful Golden Delicious, best we'd had for bloody years. And I took them into the apple and pear board the next morning, and everyone had a bruise on it, where they'd clouted a bit of metal. And of course, you never noticed it.
I know, that's dead right.
I nearly cried, Frank.
I can imagine.
They all came home again.
Yes.
Okay, so that season was extremely difficult. I would spend 4 hours fixing it and 1 hour packing, type of thing. It was called an orbit grader. Well, it bloody near put me into orbit.
Did it eventually work properly?
No.
Have you still got it in the shed?
No.
Sent it back to the
I don't know what happened to it. Poor old John, it just about tore his hair out too.
Yes.
He would go off for walks
in the orchard, thinking walks. And here we were, champing at the bit. Come on, get it finished. Get it going.
He was the guy that built it.
He was the guy that built it.
Oh, God.
Yeah. And he was a brilliant engineer.
Mm.
Yeah. But, brilliant engineers don't need a fruit season standing over the... No. Pouring it over the top of them.
It doesn't wait.
We had... there was a Yankee publication called The Good Fruit Grower, and there was a FMC grader advertised in this. Now, I think FMC had taken over from the Cutler boys some years earlier, and the Cutler had been made out of Oregon wood, old agricultural endless chain links, steel-framed canvas cups.
Mm.
Made a lot of clacking noise, but the principle was very sound.
Yes.
And it weighed the heaviest fruit first, and then it carried the rest of it to the next weigh station, and you took the heaviest fruit out, and it carried the rest of it to the next station, and you took the heaviest fruit out, and so forth down the line. So you had the biggest fruit coming out first, and you could get them pretty accurate.
Yep, sure.
So anyway, this FMC had a bit more modern gear on it. It was built of metal, and it had plastic cups.
Mm.
And it was four lanes, whereas the old Cutlers that I recall had all two lanes.
That's right.
And some of them, in latter years, came up to eight lanes.
Mm.
But the one we purchased was a four lane, and I think it cost us £15,000. Mm. And it came in big boxes. Now, this did not include the rotary bins. This was just the main frame, the singulator, which fed fruit onto the cups, and the endless chain of cups. So we had to put sorting tables and all the gear.
Mm.
And in that same year that we installed it, a chap that we had working here helping us convinced us to get rid of the trailers, and we had 18 trailers, and go to the standard flush bin. And in actual fact, when you think about it, you could stack a trailer load of fruit on the footprint of one bin. In fact, you could stack two trailer loads on the footprint of one bin.
Mm.
And you could put them in the cool store.
That's right.
You know? And you could get the fruit out of the bin without damaging it.
That's right. It's dead right.
So it all fell into place.
Mm.
Now, we had that unit for 22 years.
Mm.
And that unit was the forerunner of greater development in Hawke's Bay, and basically almost in New Zealand, because Kevin Furneaux.
That's right.
Kevin Furneaux came and looked at it, and he'd been playing around with, I think he'd made a Cutler type unit with metal cups, and I can't recall whether he did that first or after with this, but. Kevin, unfortunately, was a cocky son and a good engineer, and died of cancer miles too young an age.
I know. Mm. Yes.
So he came down and he spent weeks looking at it and discovered that the patents had run out.
Mm. Oh.
Yeah. So that's what got him underway.
Good Lord.
So he built some gear for Hawke's Bay fruit packers.
Right.
And then Neil McDonald and Kevin developed a company called Treeways.
That's right.
And then when he died, a chap who was a Freezing Works engineer.
That's right. Yes, I remember that.
Doug Clark.
That's right.
He picked it up.
Yes.
And ran with it.
Mm.
Yeah. So, and from that, Hamish Kennedy.
Mm.
Although Hamish, I think. I think by the time Hamish came along, there had been a number of FMC units imported.
Sure, sure.
There were three or four around here in the next few years. And Hamish was from Kiwi Fruitland and got into electronics.
Yes.
He wasn't quite so good, I don't think, on... his expertise lay in software rather than in hardware.
Sure, sure.
And now I think he dominates the world.
Does he really?
Well and truly.
Mm.
Yeah.
So now, during this period, you increased the size of the orchard as well.
Yeah. So, 68, I think. 68, we bought 25 acres on our western boundary.
Mm-hmm.
And my brother-in-law and his and sister took 10 acres.
Yes.
And we took the 15. Mm. So the 15 got added to Purnell.
Sure.
And then in 78, another 10 years, we purchased 20 acres in Morley Road from Selwyn Beckett.
Yes.
Selwyn had asparagus.
That's right.
And he wanted to get into grapes.
Mm.
And I think we paid $60,000 for that 20 acre.
I knew that farm very well because I sprayed it from the day he planted, or even when the chap before him had it, before it was developed. He had a Scottish name.
Oh.
McDonald? No, it wasn't McDonald. But anyway, doesn't matter. I know exactly.
And that place, and of course, that was in the years when it used to flood.
I know.
And Frank, the diversion must have been through, what, 40? At least 40 years now, wasn't it?
Oh, at least, yes.
And what a fantastic difference that made.
Oh. It used to come up through holes at this side of the stop, but it was terrible.
Oh.
But anyway, you know, when Selwyn levelled it all off and put all in asparagus, and, you know, he worked like a
Trojan
down there, and got all the money from the bank. And but I guess, you know, that's another day. So that gave you a total holding.
Brought it up to about 33 hectares.
Yes, yes.
And it's remained at that. We contemplated and endeavoured to purchase Irvin Morley's property at one stage. But he wouldn't have it. And
I remember those days you're talking about.
And Irvin was a boundary, had boundaries on our north side with extremely high, 105-foot-high poplars. And poor old Irvin, we had a 40-year war with him over those poplars.
Yes.
And how they got removed with a degree of skullduggery probably better be left there.
Now, during this period, you also were involved with the community, and I'm thinking of the tremendous amount of work you and the family put into the Blossom
Farm. Oh, okay, yeah.
And
trying to think of the guy's name that spurred us on. An orchardist from Frimley. Anyway, we'd looked at the Blossom Processions, and there was a chap that had a small orchard in Frimley. Anyway, he had been dabbling around with natural blossoms. And we thought, maybe we could have a go at that. So the next year we had, at that stage, we had a Fordson tractor with some terrible back tyres on it, which we didn't think too much about because on hard ground it would shake and rattle a bit.
Mm.
Anyway, we built this three flower deal, which was spread over the tractor, and looking in a, if you're standing out front, it was a triangular shape thing, the layout of the three flowers, and the flowers would have been 2.5 metres across.
Yes, I remember.
And we used natural flowers, camellias and daffodils and what have you, and then had a girl sitting in as the centrepiece of each flower. And I think we came second because the guy that I mentioned came first. And when I thought about it later, I thought, yeah, he had it better than we did. He had it built on a tractor too, a little Elvis, I think. But he had a branch sticking out the front, and the three flowers that he had, it was ironic that we both chose something similar, were as if they were up the stem.
Yep.
And the theme was principle of way he had done it was miles better. Yes, yes. And of course, I mentioned the tyres on the old Fords, and we lost considerable amount of vegetation and what have you on the way to town.
Yes, I can just see the treads.
Yeah, yeah, damned old thing it was. Because we had put it on smaller wheels to suit fruit, and the tyres were sort of a made-up thing I think they glued the cleats on.
Yes, that's right. Mm.
So that was the first one. And then we built a number of them and went away from the tractor. And we picked up some old vehicles. We didn't like the idea of them being towed because the frontal effect was the... was the key to it, we felt. Mm. So we got an old vehicle for the next one, and I'm trying to think what it was. I think it was a girl on a swing. And we were limited to how high you could build it, because we had to get it out the shed door.
That's right.
And we got over that later by separating the bits and then rebuilding it outside. And daffodils, I think, dominated that.
That's right. One was the teapot. You remember the teapot?
Oh.
There was one that had an outhouse at the back with a sloping...
Oh, yeah.
Was that called My Lady's Garden?
Yeah, I think it was. Then we had one with a mushroom. That was 1960.
Yes.
The year of the riot.
That's right.
And Kathy Herberson was
there. That's right. Yes.
And we see Kathy quite a bit, and she's... she's a grandmother. Like we're all bloody grandfathers now. The year of the riot, they were bringing up trains from...
Palmerston North and Wellington. Wellington, yes.
And the train arrived along with the Southerly. and Southerlies on this coast can be, old man Southerly rules the roost. So didn't they open the pubs?
That's right.
They couldn't do much else.
And that's when the fun started.
And that's when the fun started.
Raping, pillaging.
And then they had to get the fire brigade.
That's right.
And the guy they had on the fire brigade, Bryson Brown, was the biggest bloody rat bag.
I know.
And he had the end of the hose.
That's right. I know.
I don't think Bryson ever had a better day.
I'm sure he didn't. Yes, so that... that was really a great
and we built seven or eight, I
think. I know.
And then later, involvement with the Fruit Growers Association, we built a few more.
Yes.
And we did one for the centennial, which I was always quite pleased about, because we had it as a book.
Mm.
And I think we called it A Page in Time.
Oh, yes.
And had a modern couple and a...
Yep.
And I think Bob and Jill Dodd did the one, and Richard McKenzie, and I don't know whether Richard's missus did it or not, but
So that, you know, those were little community projects. That,
they were always quite good.
Gathered all your friends around you,
You're right, Frank. It was a community project.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, so we would spend the winter getting the frame ready.
Mm,
And the beauty with natural flowers, it was all a last minute effort.
Absolutely. I remember the cars all going down to. Tack about.
And we got involved once with the Junior National Party building that rocket. Were you involved?
That's right, yes.
And that was tedious because it was artificial and you spent weeks and weeks making flowers and poking them in the glue. And
I know, yeah.
So I much preferred the other one.
So then the orchard carried on.
Yep.
And do you still pack your own fruit?
Not now. No. We packed... all through the year, the 80s, and we changed graders in early 90s, and I think it was a good thing, but electronics had come on the scene then, and we bought a locally built electronic unit, which was a good unit, but progress over those years was pretty rampant in fruit grading.
Sure.
And then things got tough too.
Mm.
All through the 90s, Frank, things were not brilliant. And the 94 hailstorm slaughtered the district. We came out of that not too badly, but I always remember Johnny Moffat and I were at the top of the ag building, and Johnny looked out and said, the district will never be the same. And he was right, but I've always said I don't believe it was the hail that was that. It was marketing circumstance and discontent and of course lack of money bought this, rolled in the discontent. And
but unfortunately, the apple industry never had the true cooperative strength that the dairy board had.
And we had the reverse of the kiwi fruit industry. The kiwi fruit industry had gone from multi and had learnt the pitfalls of that. And, you know, we lost the Local Market Act, but I don't never believe that that was a problem. I've always thought that the its true destiny lay in export.
So where do you pack that fruit?
Okay, we pack it at two places now. Oh, we went out of packing about the time of the millennium.
Sure.
I had suffered some heart trouble and had a couple of stents put in. By that, we had a fruit shop fire in 96, and we were faced with what the hell to do there. And we had two folk who'd been involved with the hospitality industry working for us. The wife was running the fruit shop and doing a fantastic job. She had the right personality. And the husband was running the picking gangs, and I always believed he did a very good job. We were packing a lot of fruit, and we were packing for 13 others at that early stage. And our packhouse manager had got fed up with the pressure, and he wanted out. And we talked long and hard and decided that we would give up packing now. From a financial point of view, that was, I believe, a wrong move. From a health point of view, I suppose you could argue. I've always said if I'd carried on packing, I'd have been in the box by now. But you know, if we could have found a packhouse manager and an engineer, because that's where the pressure is, keeping gear going. And you know, if you've got 30 people there and you have a breakdown, and you've got to make a decision: can I fix it in 20 minutes, or got to send them home? And that's always a difficult call. So we went away from packing, and the went more into retail and the cafe area and tour work. We had been approached after the fire by the tourism people in Napier as to whether we'd be interested in doing fruit tours, anything of that nature. The wine industry, the grape industry in this district, had been the smaller industry, smaller than the apple industry, and it had catered for the tourist a hell of a lot better than the apple industry. And they felt that there was a niche and an opportunity to do that, and that's what helped push us into building what we built, that complex out there. And we went into it and looked long and hard as to the viability, and at that stage, of course, the couple that had hospitality experience were still with us, but then they decided to go and do their own thing in Norfolk Island, and we had a guy in the CAF that was there for 6 years, and looking back now, he was there for too long. And it was not an area that I had enough expertise in, and over the years that we've been there, there has now grown a hefty amount of competition. So it's hard going. It's hard going restoring it. But we are making progress. But of course, on the other side of that coin, time's catching up with us.
Well, I guess that's the
And now it's time to have a rethink.
And of course, you know, the time working with your parents and then,
That's right.
In the company with your brother. It's a long partnership.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, you see, I've been at this racket 62 years.
I know. You've done, done your apprenticeship.
And it's... our best years were the 80s, there's no doubt about that.
Yes,
Which I'm grateful for because it coincided with when my kids were growing up, or perhaps a little bit more.
Sure.
You know, my eldest daughter went to Massey, I think, about 84. So, yeah, and it was in those years that we had a property at the beach, and they were great years.
Yeah, sure.
And, you know, we made some mistakes there. We ventured into that thing way up country, which we shouldn't have done. But then I know folk that ventured into kiwi fruit.
Oh, absolutely.
And then pulled it out. And, and you know, I was involved with the Fruit Growers Association for 30-odd years, I suppose. But
yes, that's what I was just going to mention to you, your fruit-growing politics.
Yeah, yeah. And I remember when we... there was a in those years all of kiwi fruit that was grown in the district was packed in the district.
Yes.
And there was a chap McLeod who was getting out of organising that, and that must have been after it was all shipped up to Tauranga. And he said, you know, there was at one stage there was 35 packhouses in this district packing kiwi fruit. He said Huey Robinson down the road here, he had the best block of kiwi fruit in the district, and he pulled it out and put bloody Braeburn in.
yes, that's a story I've heard before too. Yeah, that's interesting. So just looking back, you know, you whether you chose to be an orchardist or not, I remember when I had to leave school to come home and run the farm because my father went to hospital.
Yeah.
And so I became a farmer.
Yeah.
But in the part of farming, there were other things I did, and I'm sure that you've got a lot of satisfaction, but you know, there's been some hard years.
Oh, yeah.
Fruit growing hasn't been
easy. The last 20 years have been tough. They've started to come right, I think, for the district. The irony, as far as we're concerned, is that in those years when it's starting to come right, we've been caught with adverse weather on three occasions. But again, that's the name of the game.
So. Now, just going back to the family, Mavis, who we were at your wedding many years ago.
51 or 2 or something.
Your children, what are they all doing at the moment?
Okay, well, the eldest daughter currently lives in Sydney.
Yes.
She's got 2 kids, and her husband works for Electrolux. They've had a few... He didn't start off with them. He started off with Simpson Whiteware Gear, I think it was, or might have been even another name before that.
Sure.
And you know, takeovers. They have lived in Auckland on 2 occasions, and they have lived in Singapore, and they're currently back in... Sydney, in Cronulla. Roz helps us with our accounts and advice and technical financial advice. Then the next daughter, Gillian, she did a course in travel consultancy at CIT, and said to me when it was over, when she graduated, Dad, Helen, a girl that she'd met down there, and I want to go for a holiday before we start work. And I said, oh, yes, where? Norfolk Island. So 3 years later, she was still there.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh.
And we went over there for a 21st.
Goodness me.
Then she shifted off to Garuda in Sydney for 8 years. Then, what the hell? I think she... saw the light with Garuda in the end. They were stumbling around and went to work for American Express, I think, in Sydney for a start, then came back to Auckland with American Express.
Sure.
Now she works for
ANZ Bank.
Sure.
And her partner, Rod Knight, has got a business that designs plastic plumbing fixtures.
Oh, yes, yes, yes.
In drainage and, yes. You know. And they live at near St. Luke's. Mm. That partnership's good.
Yeah.
Well, she is well travelled.
Yeah,
she's had more holidays than, you know, they came down here at Christmas in a motor caravan and went up around the East Coast.
Sure.
She rang me on the Tuesday after Auckland Anniversary Day and said, "Oh, we've just got back from Central Otago. We've been down there for 4 days."
Yes.
She, not long after starting with Garuda, Easter came up and she went to Edinburgh for Easter.
Yes.
Where she hasn't been is not worth knowing. And, yes. And the two of them are very complementary in the sense they both love trading.
Sure, sure.
Okay, so the next one's Alison, and she's married to John, and he was a pricing guy with Unison, or one of them. Now he's in the middle of another job, and they live at Hillsborough, and she's inherited two kids.
Where's Hillsborough?
Oh, in Auckland. Oh, not too Auckland. Yeah, not too far from the new motorway extension to the airport.
Yep.
So she's inherited two kids. Yeah, that's Alison. And she works for in HR for Westpac.
Right.
I think she's one of the hatchet girls. Hires and fires. So
yes. Oh, goodness me.
And Gavin. Oh, no. Joanne. Joanne is lives over here in Tauranga. Her partner is one of the Turner boys from Pukatetra.
Right.
A relationship that I'm highly delighted about. He's an excellent guy.
Mm.
And he's a design engineer and a practical engineer as well.
Mm.
Works for Patterns.
Oh, yes, yes, yes.
And does a lot of work out at Panpack.
Yeah.
So she's inherited two kids.
Right.
And Gavin. And Gavin's a kindy teacher at Palmerston North,
right.
Or early childhood.
Mm.
And he's got a boy, a girl of seven, and a boy that's two in about 4 days.
Right.
So,
right. Well,
and they live in Palmy.
Mm.
So I don't think I've missed anybody.
No, well, that seems to have completed. The only thing you need to complete now is your day. You probably have to go over and lock up the gate and...
See that they put everything away.
Yes. So I think that's pretty good.
It does enough for what you want.
Know, I think it really covers
And you'll have to sort it out, of course.
Well, we just edit it.
Yeah,